Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIS podcast series. My name is David Ledesma. I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the OIS, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Jim Henderson, who's Director of Energy Transition at the OIS. Now, for the month of October 2022, we're doing something a bit different. The OIS is running a series of podcasts focused on COP27 and the issues that are likely to be faced at the conference that is being held between the 6th and the 18th of November in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Each podcast will consist of a number of interviews with authors of the articles in the OIS Oxford Energy Forum number 33, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. This is going to be published in October 2022. David and myself will both be doing the interviews, and we hope you enjoy listening to them.
This first podcast discusses with Jim Henderson and Mary Loomi their views on the outlook for COP27. So Jim, can you remind us about the major outcomes of COP26 and whether the conference actually achieved its major goals?
Well, David, I think COP26 really should be divided into two parts. There was the overarching agenda set by the UNFCCC and the UK as the presidency. And then there was a sort of side agenda where there are a number of multilateral agreements. And coming out of the main agenda, I think the major successes would be seen as the completion of the Paris Agreement rulebook. And the main part of that, the most important part, was Article 6, which was about carbon markets. So I think that was seen as a positive. And the other thing was that there was an agreement at the end, which the presidency at least claimed kept 1.5, the target temperature target, 1.5 degrees alive. And that agreement was signed by all the 193 parties. It did include some watering down, but essentially mentioned coal for the first time, mentioned a reduction in subsidies, and also got a commitment for the nationally determined contributions to be reviewed, not once every 5 years, but actually this year in 2022. There were also a number of side agreements, the most well-known of which were one on called the Global Methane Pledge, essentially a pledge to cut methanes in the value chain of many products, particularly hydrocarbons, Zero Emission Vehicles Pledge, a deforestation pledge. So those were a power past coal pledge as well. So those were multilateral agreements signed not by all the participants, but by a number, and there were sort of more or less participants willing to sign up to those multilateral agreements. So they were generally seen as a positive as well. The big question marks, the big negatives, if you like, were around financing. There'd been a promise by the developed world to provide $100 billion of financing per annum by 2020, and that target was missed. And so there was a bit of a row about that. And then there was a further debate, I'd say heated debate, around the developing world saying you've got to provide money for not just mitigation, i.e. how we do the energy transition, how we change from hydrocarbons to green energy, but also about adaptation to climate change. Many countries are already starting to suffer from the impact of climate change. And also, most controversially, loss and damage, i.e. if we've already suffered problems, you, the developed world, really caused these problems, you need to help us pay for these problems. So those were that was the big kind of controversy, if you like, around the COP. And then the other thing worth mentioning is that there were a number of kind of interventions by various countries. So India, for example, announced a net zero target, which was quite a big surprise. Various other countries came along and made pledges. And perhaps most importantly, the Chinese and the US delegations got together and agreed that they would put other differences aside and have a real conversation about the environment during 2022 to try to come to some mutual agreements on how to set targets. And that's important because those two are the biggest global emitters. So I'd say COP26 had some positives. It had some kind of, hesitant to say negatives, but certainly things that you know you'd question about whether they were a really positive impact. But overall, I think that the mood was sort of more on the positive than the negative after the conference.
Well, you know, Jim, since then, of course, a lot has happened in terms of environmental diplomacy. So my question is, you know, has the Russia-Ukraine war been a total distraction, or is the green agenda still on track? Because as you say in your opening remarks, energy security and high prices are much higher up the short-term agenda than saving the global environment.
Well, I think that there's no doubt that the Russia-Ukraine war has been a distraction, particularly for government leaders. And so conversations about the environment have certainly taken a step back. And there's also been other geopolitical issues, like, for example, the disputes over Taiwan following the visit of Nancy Pelosi earlier in 2022, which have undermined other relationships, particularly the China-US relationship. So I think there have definitely been distractions. Energy security has certainly come to the fore. Europe has obviously been focused on trying to replace Russian gas with, yes, with renewables, but mainly with other hydrocarbons. Unfortunately, with coal to an extent, but also looking for alternative supplies of gas, particularly in the LNG market. And with the upcoming winter, obviously governments are focused on, you know, will there be a supply crisis in the short term? Will our populations be able to keep themselves warm? Can we keep industry going? So that's been the focus. Now, having said that, clearly the increased sort of interest and concentration on energy security has led to conversations around, you know, indigenous sources of energy supply. And for Europe in particular, you know, green energy, renewables, solar and wind can be, in the medium to longer term, a very important source of energy security, indigenous supply. So I think what has happened is that although in the very short term, you know, as in now, 2022, early 23, the environmental agenda has somewhat gone backwards, there is some hope, you know, catalyzed by institutions like the IEA, who have talked about, you know, how the energy transition can be a catalyst for growth, can be a catalyst for greater energy security, that over the medium term, at least, we may see that, you know, the energy transition agenda actually is benefited by this increased focus on energy security. But for the time being, in the short term, certainly it's been a distraction. And that is a concern for the negotiations at COP27 this year, because, you know, it's clear that government ministers in particular have not been particularly focused on the climate agenda. And I would add, because of high prices and because of economic concerns and because governments are spending a lot of money subsidizing customers who are having to pay high energy prices, there's not a lot of money left in the short term for paying for the energy transition agenda.
Now, Jim, the IPCC has published two major reports earlier this year. You know, what context have they set for the COP27 conference?
Well, in a nutshell, quite a frightening context, because the two reports were on mitigation and impact. And they highlighted, first of all, that we are way off target for meeting the 1.5 degree target. So essentially, the CC has said that if we want to be on track by 2030 to meet the 1.5 degree target during this century, then we have to have cut emissions by 45% by 2030. So if one bears in mind that, yes, there was a fall in 2020 because of the pandemic, but in 2021, emissions rose by 4.8%. In 2022, because of this focus on energy security and, you know, there's some switching in Europe, particularly to coal, and also in other parts of the world because gas has been so expensive, emissions are certain to rise again in 2022. And really, when you do the maths, it's pretty clear to everyone that, you know, we're not going to be on target by 2030. So that was really the main conclusion. You know, in addition, the amounts of money that we need to spend are in the multiple trillions of dollars over the next 20 to 30 years, mainly in the developing world. And, you know, those amounts of money, again, make you question whether, you know, we're remotely on target financially as well as, you know, in the emissions context. The other report was on impact. And what it showed was that many countries, well, actually, it highlighted 3.5 billion people, mainly in the developing world, are already suffering from the impact of climate change and are going to suffer significantly more. And there was one particularly interesting graph which showed that, you know, if we go to a world, even at 2 degrees, that the impacts countries are going to face are, you know, increasingly severe. And so this was a real wake-up call for the world at large, but particularly for the developing world, who are becoming increasingly vociferous about the need for support, not just to help them make the energy transition, but to help them adapt to it and recover from the financial losses they've already suffered.
Okay, Jim, so what do you see as the main focus of COP27, given it's being held in Africa? And, you know, the so-called African COP has objectives of mitigation, adaption, finance and collaboration. How are these going to be addressed?
Well, I think, you know, Egypt has painted itself as, you know, creating a COP for Africa. And so the focus is going to be very much not just on African issues, but on issues for the global south. So issues for the developing world. So there are four kind of key objectives that the Egyptian presidency has outlined. They're around mitigation, adaptation, finance, and collaboration. Mitigation I've kind of touched on, but the focus in the COP27 is going to be on implementation of targets and monitoring of progress to date. So as I mentioned, 2022 was meant to be a year where countries updated and increased the ambitions of their nationally determined contributions, their promises, if you like, to cut emissions. So there'll certainly be some hope that there'll be a review of new NDCs. And to date, there haven't been many updated, it has to be said. Also, the global stock take, which is part of the Paris process, is due to happen sort of over the next 12 to 18 months. And there'll be the first conversations about the process for the global stock take, which is essentially a full UN review of where we are on emissions. So those will be under the mitigation banner. Adaptation, I've kind of already touched on. You know, this is a big theme for the developing world. How are they going to adapt? How are they going to change their economies? How are they going to spend money on infrastructure to prepare for a world that is warmer and where climate disasters are more frequent? That's going to be a major discussion point. But I think the top item on the agenda is going to be finance. So again, we're going to come back to this issue of why haven't you paid $100 billion a year yet, developed world? Why have you not met your pledge? And by the way, that pledge is a drop in the ocean compared to the $1 trillion a year we kind of need by 2030, as identified by many independent institutions. And this is just money for the developing world. So there's going to be that. There's going to be questions around adaptation. At COP26, there was a promise to double the amount of money pledged for adaptation. And then there's this loss and damage question. But I think most importantly, actually, or equally importantly, it's not just the money, it's how the money is accessed. Because much of the money is being either offered as loans, and those loans are coming with quite high interest rates because the money is being lent into quite high risk developing world emerging countries. And what the developing world wants is a fund where they're essentially granted money, not loaned it, they're given it effectively. And the second question is around when people make promises, are they making really promises of new money, or are they playing some accounting games and actually promising money that was actually already allocated to a development budget already? And a number of global South countries are saying, look, guys, you're really just cheating us. You know, the money you're promising is money you were already going to give, and you've just reallocated the money around your budget. So what we need is new money. So I think there's lots of issues around finance that are going to be right up on the agenda. And I think particularly around loss and damage and adaptation could cause a real sort of almost a breakdown in relations, possibly, because the developing world is becoming increasingly frustrated that they're making these demands. And every year they're getting palmed off with the same old platitudes.
Well, let's come to some of the potential disputes in a second, Jim, because in your summary, you say that the best hope for COP is actually the US delegation led by John Kerry. And, you know, you say to find a path through the complex issues on the agenda and to bring together many divergent views on how the 193 parties to the conference should proceed towards the global goal of net zero emissions by mid-century. So, you know, with that in mind, what will be the key challenges at COP27? And, you know, where are we likely to see the major disputes?
Well, as I've touched on the disputes already, I mean, I think the challenges are really going to be around, firstly, getting people to focus on these issues. And I think, you know, we touched on the Russia-Ukraine war. Clearly, this is not a top short-term priority for many governments right now. The short-term priority is getting through the winter and having enough energy to do that. I think the other real challenge, it's the challenge of every COP, is, you know, to get a final document signed, a communique, if you like, you need agreement from all 193 parties. And that's very, very difficult to get unanimity on these issues. And I've already described some of the major disputes we might see around financing. Now, I think the important thing, and if indeed there's an article in the forum from Sarah Ladislaw, our colleague in the US. And I think the fact that the US have signed environmental legislation otherwise known as the Inflation Reduction Act, which is, doesn't sound very environmental, but it includes a lot of environmental catalysts. That will give John Kerry and the US delegation much more credibility at this COP than they might otherwise have had. At the last COP in Glasgow, John Kerry was very, very obvious. He was up front, leading negotiations, being an interlocutor between various parties, and as I mentioned, coming to that agreement with China. And I think his role, again, will be critical. He's a very vociferous proponent of many of the changes that are being proposed and seems to be a very, very good diplomat at bringing people together. So I think that'll be very, very important. But it will be difficult this time around, because I think that the developed world is already short of money. So making pledges to finance transition in the developing world, and certainly making pledges to compensate for loss and damage, where actually we don't really know what the number is. It's effectively like writing a blank check, is going to be very difficult for the developed world countries to do. So I think that, you know, finding some kind of compromise on the finance issue is going to be difficult. And then there are all the other questions around, you know, who's put in a new national determined contribution, and is it good enough or not? Who's prepared to sign up to reducing coal usage at this time when energy security is so important? Who's prepared to discuss some of the, you know, major technologies that are, you know, some people would accuse of greenwashing, like carbon capture and storage? All these other issues are going to be sort of, you know, debated as well. But I think the critical one is going to be finance, and that's where we could see, I think, some major rows.
Thanks, Jim. A fascinating insight, and I have to say, you know, you really set out well not only what the Forum magazine is, but you also set out the great set of podcasts we're going to be listening to over the month of October, and I hope you all enjoy them.
Okay, well, we're now going to welcome Mari Luomi from CAPSARC to the podcast, and she's going to talk about her article for the OEF called Key Issues for Policymakers to Address at COP27. So, Mari, welcome to the podcast, and let me start then with a quite general question about what do you perceive as the main expectations for COP27, and do you think the focus is going to be very much on African issues?
Well, thanks, James, so much for the invitation, first of all, to be on the podcast, and it's fully my pleasure. This will, as so many other COPs, will be a difficult COP, and there are a number of expectations. So I'll talk about two of those. One important thing, however, to keep in mind is we're talking about a very politicized process still. And one reason why the UN climate negotiations still remain so politicized is that developing countries in particular feel that developed countries have not yet held up their end of the bargain, namely providing climate finance for their emission reductions and adaptation and so forth. And this is likely to be an issue at the center stage at this COP in particular. So finance is one. And the other key issue that I'm going to talk about very briefly is called loss and damage. In terms of finance, there are high expectations. Obviously, developing countries want more of it. And that comes against the backdrop of the developed countries' failure to deliver on their $100 billion US dollars per year by 2020 pledge. There's an OECD report that came out last week, which is second part of September, which found that OECD countries mobilized and provided a total of $83 billion only. So that was 2020, so they didn't meet their pledge. And that was only already an issue at the previous COP, and that's going to just make things worse, unfortunately, probably at this COP. There's also a process to agree on a so-called new collective quantified goal, so a new climate goal for climate finance to be set before 2025. And the floor there will be this $100 billion. And this the need, obviously, the gap between what's delivered and what's needed keeps growing. So that'll be very much at the front. The other issue is that of loss and damage, which has been on the negotiating agenda in one way or another since the 90s. And it got its own article finally in the Paris Agreement in 2015, but there were no new obligations in this regard. There's a backstory where developed countries, in particular the US and EU, have for long been pushing back on discussing financing for loss and damage in particular. They fear liability claims and they fear calls for further financing. And they prefer to discuss loss and damage under the broader umbrella of adaptation. However, loss and damage is not adaptation because it happens when adaptation is no longer possible. So think of sea level rise, for example. And this is an issue on which developing countries over the past year in particular have been becoming increasingly vocal. There have been calls for a dedicated financing facility, and this loss and damage and finance, they're both issues that are very big on the African agenda. So in this sense, yes, Africa will very much feature through these discussions.
Okay, well, so we've had the Bonn intersessionals, between COP26 and COP27. So that marks an important midway point. So how did you see those two issues and indeed other issues being discussed in Bonn? And, what do you see as the implications for COP27?
Right. So if I can continue still a little bit on the theme of expectations and sort of open it up to 2022 by and large. Making this COP, this upcoming COP, was always going to be challenging in the context of what I just said. But the added turmoil of the global energy markets obviously have made it even more challenging. But the context, again, is this will be the second COP to be held after the implementation of the Paris Agreement started. And it's the first one after the Paris rulebook was fully agreed last year in Glasgow. So that means that the focus should now be on climate action at the national level rather than further negotiations. However, negotiations still are ongoing. And as I said, they're very politicized. And overall, this process has been having a hard time in shifting from this very politicized negotiations, declarations, decisions mode to a more practical focus on taking stock of what's actually happening on the ground. Now, here we have the Egyptian presidency coming into this. And in this sense, I think over this year, the presidency has, quote unquote, managed expectations quite well, in the sense that it hasn't sought to frame the upcoming COP as a milestone COP, meaning a COP that delivers big decisions. However, we have a challenge of framing success. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit later. We have a big challenge in packaging what does success mean from this conference. But on the Bonn intersessional specifically, which was your question, James, this meeting, which took place in June, it was in many ways business as usual. These mid-year meetings, which happen every year between COPs, they rarely attract much high-level attention, and therefore they don't generally address these most politicized and most difficult issues. And everybody, there's a lot of observers always that feel that they fall short, but that's kind of part of the nature of these meetings as well. The general sense coming out of this year's Bonn meeting, in my view, it confirmed what was expected, which is that, again, the COP27 will not be an easy one, given this broader global context of focus on energy security, focus on energy affordability. And it also showed how frustration among developing countries on the lack of addressing these longstanding issues of delivering support to adaptation, to loss and damage, how that frustration is growing.
Okay, so, I mean, the next question then, I guess you started to answer already, but I mean, clearly we're looking at a COP where there are going to be some major challenges. So what do you think those key challenges are going to be in terms of getting any kind of agreements? And what do you actually think a successful conference would look like?
So let's start with the challenges. That's probably easier. And then through addressing the challenges, I guess we get success then. The first one is this global context. Of course, as I said, attention is turned to energy security and affordability. And so nobody's questioning the fact that climate change is taking a backseat on the global energy agenda. How long this will last is uncertain. This year, however, what is very clear already that the prospects of raising ambitions, so higher targets, in a significant way, the prospects are looking quite bleak. And these issues include both emission targets and financing pledges. There was this Glasgow Climate Pact, one of the main outcomes from the COP last year, which requested countries to strengthen their NDCs or their national climate plan targets for the short term for 2030 and to align them with the Paris Agreement goals by the end of this year. And I just took a look, and so far less than 20 countries have updated their NDCs, And of these, there are only a handful of larger economies. And again, of this group, only one or two actually include a tangible upward increase or adjustment in their ambition. And in some ways, this was expected, but I think this year just made things even a bit more difficult. So that's one challenge. Second challenge overall for this COP, maybe not so much about managing the expectations among people in the conference, because people already know all these challenges. So these expectations might not be as low, but it will surely have, the presidency will have a hard time in communicating outcomes to global media. And so if we look back to last year, what the COP26 did, it created a number of new, what I call negotiating spaces, which are aimed at delivering more ambitious action and decisions from future COPs. And so there's the negotiating process on the new collective climate finance target. There is a process on the global goal of adaptation. There's a new track for scaling up mitigation ambition and implementation. And then there's some discussions around funding arrangements for loss and damage. And if you look at the agendas this year, countries are expected to make progress on all these areas, but none of these tracks are mandated or scheduled to deliver an outcome yet. And this makes it very difficult to define what is success from this coming COP, because there are no clear end targets at the moment on the negotiating agenda, at least. And what makes it the more challenging is that developing countries, which are the majority of countries, they expect results on issues where progress is either difficult to communicate, so think of the global adaptation goal, or it is politically unfeasible. So finance is this long-standing issue, and we're unlikely to see meaningful new announcements on it, at least at a high level. And then there's loss and damage, of course. So with these issues unresolved, also, we're unlikely to see higher mitigation ambition or emission reduction targets from developing countries again. And then there's the third, which relates to logistics. So anybody following the preparations have heard, I'm sure, that there's a large number of observers and country delegates from poorer countries that have been upset about cancellations of hotel bookings, lack of affordable accommodation. And for some reason, this COP in Egypt has attracted similar levels of observer interest than the previous COP in the UK. And that's very high, in the tens of thousands. And this again links back to the challenge of managing expectations, because the more people there are there, the more expectations there'll be around the conference delivering actually something tangible and ambitious.
Okay, so last question then, which again, you've partially answered already, so I kind of know where we're going to go with this, but COP27, has been framed by the Egyptian presidency as an implementation COP. So do you think we're going to see much evidence of major progress since COP26?
First of all, I think it's correct in my mind to frame this an implementation COP. This hopefully helps countries focus their attention on what needs to happen in the short term, because that is the most urgent challenge. Much, however, of providing this evidence of progress and implementation will not fall on the intergovernmental negotiations. It's not really a big chunk of the negotiating agenda there. It will fall on the shoulders of country leaders who come there and tell what their countries have been doing, tell what their countries maybe also plan to do, and also observers that come there to share success stories and exchange information on what's working and where progress is being made. So we'll need to wait and see how this pans out. There's definitely a need for more attention to implementation of the pledges right now. But indeed, whether it'll be this COP or the next COP that manage to kind of become that space where countries come together and share and demonstrate progress, that remains indeed to be seen. We have heard calls for every COP between now and 2030 to be kind of a critical one or a milestone one, and that's absolutely correct from a scientific perspective. However, there's also the cynic who can say that raising ambition, so higher targets, at this point doesn't make much sense if countries don't first get on track in delivering on their existing targets. So bottom line is, both ambition and implementation are needed, and they're needed desperately. So hopefully the COP can make some progress on both fronts.
Okay, well, that's a good place to end. Thank you, Mari, for your comments. And thank you again for your article at the OEF, which is being published in mid-October.
Thank you so much, James.
We would like to thank all our interviewees for their time and their excellent contributions to the October 2022 edition of the Oxford Energy Forum, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.